everyone, and welcome to another edition of In With The Old. We are a video podcast focused on dispelling myths, building appreciation for God's Word, and helping you rediscover the Old Testament for the life of faith. My name is Dr. Tim Howe, and I'm joined as ever by my co-host, Dr. Brian Koning, as we go through the book of Habakkuk, which is Dr. Brian Koning's wheelhouse. So, Dr. Brian, how are you doing today, and how are you feeling about Season 5, the book of Habakkuk?
Well, I'm doing well, and I'm enjoying being back in this book. As you said, this is kind of my wheelhouse. It's a prophet that I really dove into during my doctoral studies, but also really connected on a personal level. I think I've shared that a few times already, and it will keep coming out. The idea of someone that wrestles with their faith and is not simply content to take simplistic answers, that has helped me in my personal journey. So I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed Season 5 so far. But Tim, I've got to say, I might be having a good day so far, but I think you are having a better day because, listeners, something came in the mail yesterday. And if you're watching on YouTube, you can maybe see if I can get the glare off of it. But this is a nice little book that says at the top, Tim Howe. So, listeners, The Charge of God's Royal Children is a published version of Dr. Tim's dissertation. It just came out. Go check it out. Because I'm super proud of him, super pumped. It's great to see that out there. So congratulations, Tim. I know that's been a long, long time coming and a lot of work. But I just wanted to, before we go on with today's episode, just wanted to say congratulations. So proud of you and so happy that you're my co-host on this podcast.
Hey, well, thank you so much, Brian. And we went through that journey together, and it does feel good to have it out there. And I truly hope that it just helps build up the body of Christ. And I'm humbled and I'm grateful. So thank you so much. And all right, as we get to the text today, Habakkuk chapter 1, we went through the first four verses in our first episode, but now we're going to be going through verses 5 through 11. This is God's reply to Habakkuk. And so, listeners, I'm going to be reading these verses from the CSB, and then we're going to try and pick them apart verse by verse. So let's go for it. Habakkuk chapter 1, starting in verse 5. Look at the nations and observe. Be utterly astounded, for I am doing something in your days that you will not believe when you hear about it. Look, I'm raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter, impetuous nation that marches across the earth's open spaces to seize territories not its own. They are fierce and terrifying. Their views of justice and sovereignty stem from themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards and more fierce than wolves of the night. Their horsemen charge ahead. Their horsemen come from distant lands. They fly like eagles, swooping to devour. All of them come to do violence. Their faces are set in determination. They gather prisoners like sand. They mock kings, and rulers are a joke to them. They laugh at every fortress and build siege ramps to capture it. Then they sweep by like the wind and pass through. They are guilty. Their strength is their God. So, Brian, as we come to this, let's just remind ourselves that Habakkuk begins, right, with Habakkuk coming to God with these very deep and really angstful questions. He's bothered. He is really, in a sense, tortured by the injustice and the violence that he sees. And here we see God's answer. So, Brian, What do you see here? What do you see as significant? What are maybe some highlights, big picture, before we go into the details of this text?
Yeah, so a couple things strike me, and I think readers, if you're going through this book, will strike you the first time you read it. And one of the first ones is that God replies. And let's not skip over that. I feel like there are many conceptions of God that either feel it's disrespectful or somehow less faithful to ask questions, or maybe we're worried that if we ask questions of God, where are you in the midst of this, he doesn't reply. Well, God replies to the prophet. But alongside that, Tim, the tone is quite interesting, right? We were talking before we hit record that God is a little spicy sometimes in the Old Testament. He's got a little sass to him. Habakkuk asks God a very tough question, a very bold question. God throws it back at the prophet here. This is a very bold, a very tough reply. And just as a maybe stealing thunder from our conclusion, but there's an important lesson in this. We shouldn't be afraid to ask God tough questions. but we also need to make sure we are ready for tough answers, because God is definitely able to dish it back out. So I do like that God does reply here, and I like that he doesn't just tell the prophet to shut up, but instead he is going to tell the prophet he has some issues that he needs to fix, that is Habakkuk. But we are going to allow this questioning to run forward at least a little bit. So those are some of the things that instantly come to my mind. Tim, when you read through this, what are some of the like highlights, big pictures from God's first reply that jumps out to you?
Yeah. I think, Brian, what's so fascinating to me about God's answer is that God's answer is not an answer to Habakkuk's questions. Which just demonstrates, right, that God, in a sense, is condescending to speak to Habakkuk. And that's an act that shows that God is not insulted by Habakkuk's questions. But God immediately, just as he does in the book of Job, reframes the entire situation. So Habakkuk says, how long must I call for help? How long will you not listen? Well, God ironically shows that he is listening. But why do you force me to look at injustice? And then he goes on. God addresses the same thing that Habakkuk is talking about, but he doesn't answer Habakkuk's questions directly. And I think that's just a practical insight for all of us, that when we go to God, God gives us really blanket permission to come to him. And we can ask our questions, we can pour out our hearts. But we've got to be ready for God reframing the conversation and maybe helping us to see that our questions aren't the right starting point, and God then is going to lead us back to the right starting point. So I love this, because he essentially says to Habakkuk, I'm going to talk to you, but you need to do more listening than you need to do talking. So let's look at it, Brian. I mean, what do you see here? Walk us through some of the highlights here, starting in verse 5.
Yeah, so we jump straight in. So one of the interesting features of Habakkuk is you don't have speaker changes. So, right, we can read in a lot of narratives and you'll see, and God said, and then the prophet said, and Samuel said, and so on and so forth, right? Speaker changes are noted. Habakkuk does not note it. Instead, it's just a recording of the speeches. Now, we do know, or can make fairly strong conclusions of when a speaker change takes place, because the verbs change take place, the number and plurality of verb. We'll come back to that in a little bit. But it is clear that a new speaker vis-a-vis God is speaking in verse 5, and he starts by throwing it back in Habakkuk's face a little bit. We read, look at the nations and observe. God uses two verbs in that opening line. Both are the verbs Habakkuk used in verse 3. When he said, God, why do you make me look at injustice when oppression and violence are right in front of me? Look, observe. Those two verbs Habakkuk used, charging God, right, that he is somehow negligent or not seeing what's going on, instantly makes us aware, Tim, as you just said, no, God is aware of what is going on. It's Habakkuk that needs to look, because maybe his view is not quite correct. Now, the rest of verse 5, right, God says, look, I'm doing something in your days that you wouldn't believe even if told, and I'm going to tell you, and it's going to be shocking. This reply is interesting because it does, to me, Tim, say Habakkuk was fundamentally right in his theology of God. And what I mean is, for like Job, as a similar story, God comes to Job and says, you need to change your understanding of who I am before I can really get into the full answer of, you know, what's going on in your life. Here, Habakkuk said, this injustice seems contrary to your nature, God, and that's why I'm frustrated, right? My theology is not matching my experience. God is going to say, like, oh, you're right. I am actually correcting and punishing wickedness. Your view of me is correct. However, your view of my timing and your view of the scope in which I evaluate things is not correct, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit more unpacking. So maybe in some sense, like Job had to correct some of his theology in terms of God's scope. Habakkuk does need to be changed in some of that same way, but his fundamental nature of where evil comes from, evil is not part of God's character. Habakkuk is correct about that. As a question, Tim, as a pastor, how often do you think we fall into this trap that our view of God is too narrow. We see things in the confines and boundaries of just our own limited view. Do you think that's something we wrestle with in the church, that like Habakkuk, we need to look amongst the nations and be astounded?
Yeah, absolutely. We see this all the time. And this is in a sense what it means to be human. Humans are finite. Our perspective is limited. And anyone who's wrestled either with looking at injustice as Habakkuk did, or wrestled with issues in our own life where we ask God, why did you allow this to happen to me personally? We can't help but feel those things. I think that's actually a gift that God gives to us. We don't want to be robots. We don't want to be Spock. We don't want to act like somehow we don't love or care, or these things don't bother us. But when we examine ourselves, especially in relation to God, we've got to realize how limited our horizon is. So, Brian, you've mentioned this before, right? One of your favorite verses in end of Deuteronomy, the secret things belong to God. And to me, that's a reminder, not just that God doesn't show us everything, but it's a reminder that even if God were to reveal it to us, we do not have the ability to comprehend it. God is constantly pressing us to realize how finite our vision is. As one person said it, Brian, we may not even be able to see from A to B, but God always sees from A to Z. And at that point, it requires trust. It requires faith. But of course, this is something that every, not just Christian, but every human is going to experience, their finitude in the face of all kinds of things that are beyond their control. So yeah, this is such a practical book. It's such a practical point that God is making here. But it's a difficult one too. It's one that has a sharp edge to it, even as we know it's true. So Brian, what about you? What do you think about this?
Yeah, I think it's a common trap we can fall into. I really like Mark Twain in an almost ironic sense. He obviously had a lot of, shall we say, baggage in how he approached life, but he also had some interesting witticisms. And one of the ones I really have always latched on to as painfully true is Twain said, "In the beginning, God created man in his own image, and we've returned the favor ever since." The idea that our conceptions of God usually are just limited to, he's a bigger version of us, and of course he's going to think like us and have the same priorities as us. And it's passages like this in Habakkuk 1:5 where I think it's a good reminder to say, no, step back. Look among the nations and be astounded. I love the phrase you used. We don't always see A to B, but God sees A to Z. Sometimes we need to be reminded of that. And Habakkuk needs to be reminded of that. And the people of Israel need to be reminded of that. Remember, listeners, where I said that the verbs help us see the person change here, or speaker change? These verbs, to look and observe, are not second person singular, as if it was directed to Habakkuk. Instead, they are in the plural. God is telling the nation that they need to understand. This is being voiced from Habakkuk's perspective, but it's a question we all share and a lesson we all need to learn. We need to see seeing what God is doing. And what is God doing? Well, something kind of shocking. He says in verse 6, "I'm raising up the Chaldeans." Now, this is shocking, Tim, on a theological level, on a cultural level, on a historical level, right? This would have raised eyebrows. This would have led to outrage, and it does. Habakkuk's going to complain after God's done telling him off. But there's a couple things we should note here. First, ancient Near Eastern conceptions of gods, right, Tim? Gods are bound to the land of their people, right? When you want to think of gods, they're at this nexus point of people, land, and the religion that follows them. And so the gods of Egypt are found in Egypt, but you wouldn't, from a cultural perspective, expect to find them in Babylon. The gods of Babylon would be there, but not in Israel, and so on and so forth, right? The gods take care of the affairs of their own nations. Here, however, Yahweh of the Old Testament says, "I'm meddling in the affairs of another nation." And that is completely consistent with the Old Testament, because Yahweh of the Old Testament is not just a God of one nation, but a God of the universe, a God of the entire world, all peoples. But it would be shocking still, right, to their culture that he is like, oh, I'm doing things in other parts of the world. That's part of the, you need to look up and see more of what's going on, right? So it's culturally kind of odd. It's theologically kind of odd in that way. Historically, too, we look back and go, oh, the Babylonian Empire, right? This is going to be a world beater. They're going to try to set the speed record for the quickest to rise, quickest to fall ancient Near Eastern empire in history, because they do have a fairly meteoric rise and fall, which is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. But at the time when this is written, and we talked about dating two episodes back, go re-listen to that one if you want to know about when we are in the timeline. But the Chaldeans at this point are a puppet state, or maybe just a brand new country on their own. They've maybe just overthrown Assyrian home rule. To put it in modern context, Tim, I don't know what country you might go to. I would say this would be like a oracle coming to the U.S. saying, look, I'm raising up Madagascar to come take you out. You'd go, of course, I'm aware of that country, but really? That's kind of far away. They have no business being over here. They have no influence on us. It's not a perfect analogy, but it would have shocked the initial readers, wouldn't it, that the Chaldeans are going to be raised up for some purpose. What do you see there, Tim, with the Chaldeans? Anything else we want to add on about how shocking it is that they're being name dropped here?
Yeah, I don't have anything to add about the shock value of it, but I do want to just double down on what you said. God, the God of Israel, makes the audacious claim that he has the rights and power over the gods of other nations and over the nations themselves. So one of the features of the Old Testament that's striking is that God sends prophets to proclaim oracles against other nations. You know this, Brian, even as we look at the New Testament, it was still true even in the New Testament era that nations tended to recognize and at least acknowledge the gods that other nations worshiped, which is why early Christians or Jews before them were referred to as atheists by the Greeks and the Romans, because the Jews only worshiped one God. To us, monotheism is a given. To them, it was the exact opposite. They believed and to a lot of degree accepted the existence of other gods of other nations, but the God of Israel is the creator God, the God over all other gods, the God who claims sovereignty over other nations. So I think of even the images in Isaiah where he says, I'm whistling for the Assyrians and the Egyptians and all of these other gods and all of these other nations that think they are ruling and reigning. They actually all work for me. And in fact, as we read in Isaiah, they are no gods at all. But
yeah,
I want to just double down on that point. This is God exercising his authority, at which point it raises another question. Well, God, if you're able to do that to the Chaldeans, why don't you just do something about our people? If you have this power, then why don't you just exercise it in a different way? But of course, God has the right to do with his power what he will. So interesting. It kind of complicates the question. But God here is asserting his authority unquestioningly. Absolutely.
Yeah. And the answer, as you just alluded to, is going to raise some follow-on questions. Mm-hmm. Because God says he's raising the Chaldeans in verse 6. And then through verse 10, he describes them. And it's not the most flattering like profile you will ever see on LinkedIn. He describes them. Look at the adjectives in this passage that Tim read for us. They're bitter, impetuous, fierce. Mm-hmm. Terrifying. They're described as conquerors, right? The people who take territories not their own. They destroy fortifications, not a inconsequential thing before the serious advent of siege warfare, right? We think of like medieval European warfare. You still had earthen ramps, and it was difficult though to take out fortified cities. This people will. They will mock kings, right? This is a terrifying description of the Chaldeans. And then God puts the cherry on top for pouring coals on Habakkuk's head. They're non-believers. They are not people who are going to recognize Yahweh as the one granting them victory. So after this whole discussion of how fearsome and powerful they are, right, in verse 11, in verse 7, their views of justice and sovereignty stem from themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's significant, right? They don't actually believe in Yahweh. They don't follow after him. Instead, mm-hmm. they trust in their own authority. And in verse 11, it's going to see they say their strength is their God.
Mm-hmm.
Now I have a question kind of for us listeners. What do we make of this?
Mm-hmm.
God is using the wicked as well as the righteous to further his plans.
Mm-hmm.
What do we make of the wicked being used in his plans? So like we're all about, hey, God, use me because I'm a good person to further your kingdom. But here it's almost the opposite, right, Tim? He's using the wicked. Habakkuk is definitely going to have a lot more to say, but I want us to kind of stop and think about this for a second. Maybe pastorally, what are some of the things we need to unpack here or really sit and wrestle with, Tim?
Yeah, well, these questions are why Habakkuk is so relevant. As we think about God's sovereignty over wickedness, God allows wickedness to continue, but he also makes sure that we understand he is keeping it within its banks. And here's what I mean by this. There is no wickedness that God cannot and does not use for his purposes. Habakkuk says, God, why are you ignoring the wickedness in Israel? Why are you allowing this to continue? And God says, not only am I not ignoring it, I recognize the wickedness of the other nations, and I am going to use that wickedness as a part of my plan. So this is, in a sense, an exertion, a statement of God's power and his willingness to use wickedness in a way that Habakkuk never could have understood. So it's almost like he's saying, Habakkuk, I'm calling you, and then I'm raising you. I see it, mm-hmm. and I'm addressing it, which, again, is not necessarily a comfort, even if it's true. So God, as you said, Brian, is sort of calling Habakkuk's limitation out to the carpet while also saying, I invite you to look at it a little bit from my perspective. And then the second thing I'll say just briefly, Brian, is that this is God, I think, reminding Habakkuk, you have no right to claim that I am blind. Not only do I know what's going on in Israel, I know what's going on through the whole earth. And I am addressing it, but in a way that again, is not going to make sense to you. But it's almost like God is pushing back and saying, you think you know wickedness? Guess what? I get the panoramic vision. I see the wickedness of the Chaldeans, and yet I'm going to use them as a vessel in my hand. So I think those things are both there and relevant.
Oh yeah, precisely. He is it throwing it right back. We started this section by saying he threw the verbs back at Habakkuk, and here is more of an all-encompassing rebuttal. Like, you're worried about wickedness in this country. You have no idea what true wickedness is, and you think it's bad now. It's getting worse, and yet we're going to need to wrestle with that as the book continues to unfold, right? That's part of the message that we're going to really dig into.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Tim, when you read through this, and when I read through this book for the first time, verse 11 always stuck out as odd. Then they sweep by like the wind and pass through. They are guilty. Their strength is their God. Even as I was getting into my doctoral studies, I'm like, that the phrasing of that feels odd. And so just before we leave the section, we do need to make a note. For being a small book, Habakkuk has its fair share of textual issues and problems, and we have one here. This final verse, although it's just eight words in Hebrew, has five conjectural readings or issues listed in the apparatus of the BHS, which is the academic kind of text for the Old Testament, the Biblia Hebraica Studentgartensia. There you go. That's a tongue twister. But yeah, eight words, five issues in those eight words. So an important thing, if we leave it like most English translations do, that's the consonantal text with the standard Masoretic vowels. It simply is God's final verdict on the speed of Babylon's victory and the fact that ultimately they're guilty. Their strength is their God, not Yahweh, which will lead to his point that they too will face punishment eventually. However, an interesting thing about Hebrew is there's a consonantal text, Tim, and then there's vowels. And the vowels are a late addition. They're added in by the Masoretes to reflect how those words are being pronounced, but not till the 10th, maybe even 11th century AD, right? So occasionally we have to look at this and go, are there other vowels that would make better sense and make better, make better sense to our reading, especially as we compare it to the Greek and the Aramaic and our other ancient Near Eastern copies, right? Mm. Well, this was something that was tangential, but argued in my dissertation, and it's not original to me. Roberts also argues for this in his commentary on Habakkuk. But if we supply different vowels, this verse actually changes to be read this way. So verse 11 would read, "Then the spirit passed on and went its way, and I was devastated. This one, whose strength is his God," with a kind of question mark at the end. Obviously, that would have to be supplied. We don't have question marks in Hebrew. But the idea would be kind of rhetorical dismay. This verse then would switch from being God talking about the Babylonians to Habakkuk seeing the spirit who has come and delivered this message from God leaving, and him expressing being dumbfounded, devastated is the word that would be there, and kind of asking, this one? How could God use this one whose strength is his God? Why would this be your agent of punishment? That will fit the context, because spoiler alert for next week, Habakkuk is not done complaining. He's still got some words to get in here. And his complaint is basically going to be, how dare you, God? Or why are you going to use someone more wicked than us to punish us? How does that make sense? Right? And so verse 11 read in this alternate way actually makes a good deal of sense. Introing that debate, both ways fit the context of the book. I just want to make it aware. This is a verse where I think we've got some question marks on how best to render it. But there is this kind of alternative out there. That being said, I don't think that touches our big idea for this passage, Tim. And if I could sum up the big idea for the section, it's that God's ways are not our ways, right? Even when we see no movement, even when we think God is absent, God is reminding the prophet and reminding us he is active, and his work is often much far beyond what we would expect it to be, right? We often have too limited of an expectation when it comes to God. So that's my kind of run through of verse 11, summary of the big idea of this section. Tim, maybe bring it on home for us and our listeners.
Yeah, well, thank you for that mini lesson on the textual issue there, Brian. It really is interesting. And sometime we need to do a whole episode on just the textual issues of the Old Testament and help our readers in those ways. But I think you're right, Brian. As we look to this main idea, I just want us to embrace our finitude. And here's what I mean by this. It's not only that we don't comprehend. It's not only that we can't comprehend. God is the only one who has the ability to fully see and fully respond in righteousness. And even if we could understand the fullness of injustice in our own lives or in the world at large, because of who we are, we just don't have the power to do anything about it. And this is where God is not just trusting us with the knowledge that he knows, he's also wanting us to trust that he is a God of justice. And just ending where we began, Brian, it's almost as though God is saying, Habakkuk, you believe the right thing about me, but you haven't fully understood even your own beliefs. And in that sense, this book is a mercy of God drawing out the implications of what Habakkuk already believes, but then helping him see the tension of one belief versus another. His problem is what? God, if this is what you know and this is who you are, why haven't you done anything yet? And God is essentially saying to Habakkuk, hold on, I'm doing something more than you realize, but you can trust that I am a God of justice. So an amazing start, an amazing reply, as you said. It's just getting started. And so next time we're going to be moving to the last part of Habakkuk chapter 1 and Habakkuk's reply to God. And it's an absolutely incredible part of this text. So Dr. Brian, thank you for joining me today. Listeners, thank you for joining us. And until next time, you know what to do. Stay cool and stay old.